Tonight on ESPN, our look back at baseball's greatest games continues with Game 6 of the 2001 World Series. David Freese became one of the most unlikely World Series heroes as he carried the Cardinals past the Rangers. That's tonight, 7 Eastern on ESPN and on the ESPN app. It's a really interesting morning in the world of sports as we get one day removed from Last Dance. You have LeBron James last night with comments. And listen, if Brian Windhorst in our first hour was correct, and we'll revisit this, if people criticize him for what he said, boy, do I think they are missing the boat. You will hear that from him, and you will hear why there is a hint of optimism in the air for all of us who are sports fans as we start a new hour of Get Up right now. Here we go. It is time to get up with the return of sports. It's in the air. Starting with baseball, plans are in place. How close are they? We've got the answers right off the top. Ben, you heard what he said, but what will he do? Aaron Rodgers on his future, short-term and long. We'll hear from Dan and Lewis. Plus, Jay Billis is not happy with us. And now we're going to hear about it. We will have an airing of grievances in this hour of Get Up, which starts right now with Get Up and Go, as always, around the world of sports. And this was very interesting. During a visit at the White House yesterday, Rockets owner Tillman Fertitta said he believes the NBA will find a way to finish the 2020 season. He was on hand as part of a roundtable with restaurant executives. Brian Windhorst told us they've got about 2 weeks before they have to start making hard, fast plans. As to the NHL, they've narrowed down their list to 8 or 9 sites if the league does resume play this summer. The NHL is working on a plan to host a dozen or so teams at select bubble sites and play multiple games per day. The governors of New York, California, and Texas all announced yesterday that professional sports can resume in those states without fans in the near future. So they joined Florida and Arizona, who have recently opened their states for professional sports. And this feels very significant because these three states are the most populated ones in the country. So no surprise, a lot of teams could be affected by this. Among the four major sports leagues in America, 27% of the teams reside in these three states, including huge brands like the Yankees, the Cowboys, and the Lakers. Let's start with baseball and bring in our Jeff Passan here. Jeff, what impact do you think these statements from these governors have on baseball's ability to move forward?
Well, Greeny, it certainly doesn't hurt baseball's efforts, but we also have to understand this is a multifaceted process. And as much as governors want to think that they've got the power to bring sports back in their state, it's going to be going through a couple different levels before we get those teams back. Remember, you've got local officials as well, like mayors and like city councils and all sorts of different politicians who can stymie those types of efforts. But even more, it's the local health officials, Greeny, who are going to be the ones to rubber stamp these sports coming back. They're going to look at the plans and the protocols that these leagues have in place and say, we believe that you are going to be safe for yourself and for the public, or we believe you are going to be a hazard and we're not going to allow you to play.
All right. Now, on baseball's side, they released a lengthy memo. It was some 67 pages about safety procedures and plans. I'm not expecting most of our fans to read all of it. So what are the most important things?
There's a lot in there, Greeny. And what it really comes down to is as much what you're not allowed to do as what you are. And this shows the lengths to which baseball is going to try and be thorough and get on the sides of those health commissions that are going to look at this document and say, okay, you're outlawing spitting, hot tubs, cold tubs, Gatorade jugs on the bench. Players aren't allowed to stand next to each other during the national anthem. You're suggesting maybe you guys don't even take showers post-game? Like, there's a lot in there. And listen, I think the shower stuff's going to go away. Players didn't take too kindly to that. But you need a document like this to start. And it was just a draft memo that they're getting feedback from Major League Baseball teams as well as the Players Association on. There's going to be some progress this week on in this regard with health and safety. And I think that they can come to an agreement there. In the end, though, Greeny, it's going to come down to money with the players in Major League Baseball. And they are still at an impasse there at this point. Listen, they've got a couple of weeks, and once those couple of weeks are over, either they're going to be starting spring training in mid-June or they're going to be back at the drawing board, and that's a place where nobody wants to be right now.
I got you. So again, just to sort of wrap this up here in just a few seconds, The timetable is really rapidly approaching us, right? If they want to start spring training sometime in June, we're already getting to be in late May. How quickly do they need to move forward in an agreement here?
Yeah, this deal needs to be done with May still on the date. Like that, it's as simple as that. If you don't have that, then you will not have baseball in early July, starting off actual regular season games. You will not have spring training. There's so much logistically, Greeny, that needs to get done that this 67-page plan outlines. And whether it's physicians, whether it's teams, whether it's players, you need to have everything running as smoothly as possible if you want to hit those timetables.
All right, if that happened in May, then we're talking about less than 2 weeks. Today is the 19th. We'll see where it winds up. Jeff, awesome. Thank you very much. Meanwhile, we turn our attention to the NFL, where Aaron Rodgers spoke with the media on Friday for the first time since his team drafted his potential replacement in Jordan Love, trading up to do so. Rodgers spoke candidly about his reaction to that pick.
General reaction at first was surprise, I think, like many people. You know, obviously, I'm not going to say that I was, you know, thrilled by the pick necessarily, but I understand the organization is thinking not only about the present, but about the future. And I respect that. I think what it does is just reinforce kind of the adage that you can only control what you can control. And so my, you know, sincere desire to start and finish with the same organization, just as it has with many other players over the years, you know, may not be a reality at this point. And as much as I understand the organization's future outlook and wanting to make sure they're thinking about the team now and down the line, and I respect that. You know, at the same time, I still believe in myself and I have a strong desire to play into my 40s, and I'm just not sure how that all works together at this point.
Wow, that was a lot. And it was something we did not get a real chance to dive deeply into yesterday because we had so much from The Last Dance. But Dan Orlovsky, let me start with you. We were all waited to hear exactly how Aaron Rodgers would react to this pick. Publicly, at least, that was his first reaction. What did you think of it?
Well, he handled it like a pro, Greeny, but this has been a couple kind of public comments that he's made that I think are very telling. You know, when he uses the phrase, my sincerest desire to play for one organization, like he's telling us that was always his plan. And now a massive wrench has been thrown into that plan with the Packers kind of obviously drafting of Jordan Love and their preparations for the future. I think the reality comes down to this, Greeny. If the Packers are playing well and Aaron Rodgers is playing well, this probably will not be a massive talking conversation over the next year or two. But I want to bring everyone back to about a year and a half ago when the Packers were in between their coaching staff or the coaching decision with Mike McCarthy. And Aaron Rodgers was outward and saying that they played in San Francisco 2 years ago. And he remembered standing on the sidelines and saying, I want to play for an offense that looks like that. One that's fun for a quarterback to look like that. Ball is going down the field all over the place. So they bring in Matt LaFleur, somebody who runs a very similar scheme to Kyle Shanahan. Now, that offense for Green Bay last year was okay. It was middle of the pack in a lot of different things. And so if that offense stays middle of the pack and is just kind of okay, then the whispers are going to start. And then the conversations are going to start that maybe Aaron isn't good enough anymore. Or did they not surround him with good enough people? Man, Jordan Love is ripping it up in practice. And so that's when the real story or the real emotions will come into play here. But if the Packers are winning football games and he's playing great football, it won't. But let this turn into a struggle for him and their offense over the next season, and this will get ugly.
Yeah, winning always covers up issues. But, Lewis, you know, we talked about this right after the draft, questioning the pick. Now that Aaron has weighed in and we can sort of sit back and digest what it all means, what are your thoughts today?
Yeah, I think first and foremost for Aaron Rodgers, I think he showed a level of maturity that I think many people really weren't counting on him showing. I think people thought he would have a much more visceral, emotional reaction to all this, but I think Aaron sees what is happening, and he's someone who's a historian of the game. He's someone who studies the history of the game, and he understands, look, the situation was very similar for him when he came into the league. So I think he understands what's happening. He may not like what's happening because, again, as Dan alluded to, his desire to really play for one football team his entire career, but he sees what's happening. He sees that it's not going to be in his control. and he sees that some other things outside of his circle of control are going to be really what drives whether, you know, when he moves on. That namely being, how quickly does Jordan Love come along? And then from a contractual standpoint, when does it make sense for the Packers to move on from him? It really doesn't make sense for them to move on from him in 2021, but once 2022, once that new league year starts in 2022, that's when Brian Gutekunst and Matt LaFleur are really going to have to decide, okay, is now the time? Is Jordan ready? Because now we can really swallow this cap hit and we can move forward. That's really the reality of the situation. That's what the Packers are gearing towards, and that's really what Aaron is going to have to start planning for.
I agree with everything you said. Everything you said is right because of the amount of money they owe him. But here we are talking about a situation where a team is looking forward to the moment when they can get out from under having Aaron Rodgers at their quarterback. It just doesn't make any sense to me. So, Diana, if all of us are reacting this way, what are you hearing from people around the league, particularly as it regards Rodgers' long-term future?
Well, Greeny, you said you guys couldn't get to this topic on Monday because of The Last Dance, where we watched Michael Jordan basically make up slights to stay motivated. This is exactly who Aaron Rodgers is, except this slight isn't made up. If there's any quarterback in this league who is fueled by people doubting him, it is Aaron Rodgers. And all he has to do is look over to New England with what happened when they drafted Jimmy Garoppolo. And we all thought that Jimmy G was going to take over the reins and Tom Brady was done. And Tom Brady used that to motivate and play well. And what did they do? They moved on from Jimmy, and Brady continued to have a successful career. So while he handled this, I think, maturely, we all know Aaron Rodgers is the most calculated person probably in the NFL. So he said all the right things. But I think if there is one season where we're going to see the biggest step from Aaron Rodgers' play, it's now, because he wants to show Green Bay, hey, guys, I ain't done yet.
Yeah, I'm with you. I called it a scorched earth tour last season. It didn't fully materialize. Let's see in the second year in this offense if he can do it. Much more as we continue here. And coming up, we talked about Michael Jordan and The Last Dance. For those intent on comparing Jordan and LeBron, our Jay Billis wants a word. He texted me yesterday. He's aggravated with us, and he's going to explain why right after this.
It's your home speaking, and I need you to do me a couple of favors. First, could you get that blueberry that rolled under the fridge last week? It's throwing my feng shui off. Second thing, bundle your home and car insurance with GEICO. It's easy, and we could save money. Lastly, I know you were thinking of painting the nursery back to off-white, but I'm actually feeling this baby blue. Didn't think it was my color, but I am pulling it off.
GEICO. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
Foot odor throwing you off your game? Stick to a winning game plan with Odor Eaters, featuring three advanced odor and wetness fighters. The lineup provides long-lasting odor control plus more to keep your feet on their game.
Odor Eaters powder provides outstanding moisture control. Clear drying spray is the MVP in preventing athlete's foot, while insoles work continuously to manage wetness while adding a layer of comfort. Pick up today at Walmart, Target, CVS, Dollar General, or other fine retailers.
Odor Eaters. Destroy foot odor with the best in odor defense.
In the wake of Last Dance, we've asked each of our contributors this morning to talk about what was their MJ moment. And Lewis chose this one, Jordan, on how he pushed his teammates to excellence.
This, I'm only doing it because it is who I am. That's how I played the game. That was my mentality. If you don't want to play that way, don't play that way. Break.
Lewis Riddick, why was that your MJ moment?
Yeah, Greeny, I'll tell you what, that gives me goosebumps. That makes me start feeling emotional watching that, because what he's sitting there and he's doing is he's saying, look, you want this myth. How do you think I became this myth? How do you think I became this guy who across, you know, social boundaries and across sports boundaries throughout, you know, the history of time? How do you think I became this guy? It takes a special kind of dedication, a special kind of motivation, a special kind of perseverance that you're not going to be comfortable with. And you want to know how I became this guy? That's how I became this guy. That's how I became this myth that all of you revere. And now I'm sitting here having to defend myself. I'm having to apologize for it. I totally bought into what he was saying right there. I remember when I watched that live, live. I literally, as it went to commercial break, I sat there with my mouth just hanging open going, that's everything to me right there. And I'll tell you, I replay that episode over and over again because it is so powerful, Greeny.
No question.
It's so powerful.
That was one of the stop your everything else you're doing kind of moments from the piece. All right, well done. Thank you very much, Lewis. Now stay there because I want to bring Jay Billis into the conversation because he was also watching Last Dance. And he had this to say on trying to compare eras. All right, this is what he tweeted yesterday, and he tweeted it along with this image. MJ is the best ever. That's an enormous compliment given the greatness of others. Yet some say today's players wouldn't be dominant in the 80s or 90s. Not true. Or do we similarly believe the 80s and 90s players wouldn't be dominant in the 60s? Today's player is better than ever. Now just look at those numbers on your screen. Bill Russell won MVP in 1962 despite the fact that Wilt Chamberlain averaged 50 points and 25 rebounds. Look at Oscar Robertson's numbers. Look at Elgin Baylor's numbers, 38 points and 18 rebounds coming off the bench that year. So, Jay, this all started with a text you sent me right after the show, in which you made it pretty clear you were not happy with some of the things you heard said here on Get Up yesterday, which I'm totally good with. I want to give you the floor. What is it about the generation of players today that you think people are missing?
Well, I think it's this romanticism of yesteryear in light of The Last Dance. Look, I loved every minute of The Last Dance, and I've loved every minute of the Michael Jordan retrospective. You know, I played against Jordan in college and thought he was amazing then and now. I think he's the greatest ever. But that's a profound compliment to say that you think someone's the best ever. It doesn't diminish who's second or third. Like, I'm saying Michael Jordan is better than Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. That's profound given the greatness of Kareem. But this idea that somehow today's player would not be dominant back in the 80s or 90s because they could hand check back then or the game was different, I find that ludicrous. The idea that LeBron, Durant, Kawhi, Giannis, Doncic, you know, Harden, Westbrook, Curry, you name it, Klay Thompson, they wouldn't be dominant back then. They might not have beaten Jordan's Bulls, but the players of the 80s took them to seven games. And, you know, Jordan and Pippen, those guys, they beat, I think it was seven teams. They eliminated seven teams that had won 60 or more games. They were great. But I don't ever hear any of these, you know, similarly old men like me saying that, wait a minute now, the players of the 80s or 90s, they would have really struggled against the players of the 60s. And I kind of wonder, like, I'm a reverse get off my lawn guy here. I kind of wonder when this precipitous decline of skill and toughness started. Did it start in 99? Because I don't buy this. I think the players today are better than ever. And we do this only in basketball. I've never heard anybody say, you think Patrick Mahomes could have got a pass past Ray Nitschke? Or Mike Trout, you think he could have hit that crazy sidewinder stuff of Kent Tekulve? Forget it. Simone Biles, you think she could have beaten Olga Corbett in her prime? We never say that nonsense. But we say it in basketball, and somehow we believe it because they could hand check back then.
Now,
that doesn't make any sense.
Let me throw a thought at you here. I do not think anyone, I for the most part, agree with the fact that we only tend to do this in basketball. I completely agree with you. The players of today are more skilled than ever before, and they avail themselves of things that are available to them today in the areas of technology and medicine and things like that, and that would make them greater athletes. But when Mark Jackson said they're cut from a different cloth, do you see that? Because you're around young people now. You're around college-level athletes and all that all the time. Do you think the mentality of the young people coming up in the sport today is similar to the mentality of young people coming up in the sport when you were one of them?
Yes, absolutely. I don't buy for one second that because Tom Brady was born in the 70s and that these current players in the NBA were born in the 70s or 80s, that somehow they don't know what competition is. And that all died out with players that were born in the 60s. That's nonsense. And it's similarly nonsense that somehow the players in the 80s or 90s weren't as tough-minded as the players who played in the 60s. Look, like the greatest generation ran up Omaha Beach. I have tremendous respect for that. But courage and greatness didn't die out when, you know, when later generations came along. That just doesn't make any sense to me. The players today are competitive. Like, and this is all in light of Michael Jordan being the greatest and watching that. You know, Jordan's attitude and his drive, I think, are unmatched. But it doesn't mean those that were with him didn't have similar drive. It might not have been as good, or that his leader, like, you win and everything's justified. His leadership style is maybe questioned by some. I don't have any problem with it. And the fact is, he won with it. But that doesn't mean that other leadership styles don't work as well.
Yeah.
And would not win. There have been a lot of championships won since then. Jordan's just the greatest, and that's a profound compliment. But the idea that today's player wouldn't be dominant back then is to me ludicrous.
I don't disagree with that. Guys, I'm going to keep it here because I want to stay on this conversation. Here's the difference, Jay, or a difference that I see. If you look back at the early part of Michael Jordan's career, when he was coming back from a bad injury and the team was begging him not to go out there and play, he was insisting on going out and playing. He played 82 games a year, each of the three seasons of their second three-peat. The notion that players today preserve themselves in the way that they do, the idea of rest and all that kind of stuff that we see in the sport today, that I think is one of the reasons people point to. If you told Michael Jordan that we're going to sit you out of this game because we're playing three games in four nights, which they don't even do anymore, by the way, I think that's where you might see some of the difference in mentality.
Well, I mean, some of the different, I don't think the mentality is any different. I honestly don't. I think these players play incredibly, but they're looking at a different landscape now. I mean, that's like saying back in the day, pitchers, like Tom Seaver never came out of a game for a reliever. He played, he pitched complete games. And now Clayton Kershaw comes out after the sixth inning or the seventh inning. The game has changed. And the landscape has changed. You know, even back when MJ was injured, Jerry Reinsdorf and his team were looking out for their investment.
Right.
And the investment back then was not as profound in a player as it is now. They put a 7-minute restriction on him. He fought against it and ultimately was allowed to play more. But you know, the idea that players aren't playing hurt now or they don't want to do it, I just don't buy that. I think they compete just as hard. I don't buy that somehow, you know, Tom Brady, because, you know, isn't as tough as Joe Montana because the rules are different and you can't hit him like you used to. I just don't buy that.
I don't know if I buy it necessarily either. And, of course, I didn't play any of these games, but it does seem to me I can understand where Joe Montana might watch this and say, you know what, if I wasn't getting hit the way he's not getting hit, then I'd be putting up numbers like he is. Like, I'm usually the first person to criticize people for saying that, but I kind of get where they're coming from.
I get where they're coming from, too. Like, I think if I were Oscar Robertson, I'd be looking today saying, I can't believe these guys are making this much money when I average triple doubles and they're celebrating Russell. Of course you do. Look, that's what old men do, is they say, you wouldn't believe how tough it was when I played. But the guys now are better than ever because none of them say, well, I couldn't have played 20 years before I did. It all starts with them, and then it moves forward, and nobody's as good. Nobody looks backward and said, hey, I couldn't have played back. Our guys couldn't have played back then when everybody was tougher. Doesn't work that way for anybody.
All right, they're yelling at me because I went too long on this, but I really enjoyed it. Jay, thank you. Feel free to text me angrily anytime you want. As we continue, 2011 was a lockout season. LeBron says he considered a career change. Wait till you hear what he considered doing, and you will. Next.
Geico has the insurance industry-leading app that lets you manage your policy anytime, anywhere, which means that Geico is always there for you, if only everyone was always there for you. Like animal control, when you're cornered in your garage by an angry possum.
Hi, me again. You guys said you would be here about an hour ago, and I think the possum is starting to get angry. Listen, I thought if I fed it, it would go away, but now it is ripping holes in the drywall and making some sort of nest. Just call me back.
Geico, always there for you with savings and the industry-leading mobile app.
We are back on Get Up, and Best Defense is brought to you by Meguiar's. And here we go. Could LeBron James have played in the NFL? Last night on his uninterrupted YouTube channel, the three-time NBA champ said he gave some thought to a career change during the 2011 lockout and possibly playing for the Cowboys. Listen.
Was football ever even a thought for you during that year?
You know what? To be honest, PR, it actually was. I had no idea how long the lockout was going to be. And myself and my trainer, Mike Mancias, we really started to actually train to be a football player when it came to like October and November.
Did you get the call from Bron saying, hey, I might want to do this?
I did not, but I know he got a contract from Jerry Jones that he framed and put in his office.
All right. I'm interested. Here we go with Dan and Lewis. Lewis, I'm starting with you. If you're drafting LeBron James, at what position are you drafting him? What's he playing?
Offensive weapon. That's what he's playing, okay? So you can call him a tight end, you can call him a big wide receiver, but you need to have this guy with the ball in his hands, and you need him down the field. Think of, what's LeBron, 6'8", 6'7", 6'8", 250 pounds, 240 pounds? I mean, it was rumored that Michael Jordan ran in the 4.3s in the 40. I'd love to see what LeBron actually ran in the 40-yard dash. And you know his vertical is just sick, 40-plus, whatever that is. And you see what kind of body control and what kind of hand-eye coordination he has. Can you imagine him in the middle of the field as a tight end in a flex position going against today's linebackers and safeties? It would be unfair. Tom Brady in particular would sit there and go, yeah, sign him up on my team. Because LeBron would be unstoppable in that regard. He really would. So, look, I'd just put him on offense and I'd move him all over the place. And you can best believe 50-50 balls would be being thrown up on a regular basis.
Hey, Orlovsky, let me throw a different thought in there. Maybe Brady wouldn't want him on his team because LeBron's the greatest passer I've ever seen. How about if I try to put LeBron James at quarterback? What do you think?
Greeny, that's so disrespectful to quarterbacks, man. There's no shot. I agree with Lewis. Put him at wide receiver, flex tight end. I'd put him at defensive end. There's no shot that you're putting LeBron at quarterback. First of all, he's too long. I mean, his throwing motion would be way too long. If you look at guys like Dan McGuire or Paxton Lynch, these guys, these long-levered players, DBs would eat that up. And Greeny, if he ever ran, with all due respect to LeBron James, guys would saw him off at the knees. I mean, there is a 6'9 target that guys would be firing at his knees. And I don't know how much a 6'9 guy would necessarily want that happening at that position. There's no shot LeBron could play quarterback in the NFL. Maybe wide receiver, maybe tight end, maybe defensive end. But don't disrespect quarterbacks like that.
Well, the segment is Best Defense, brought to you by McGuire. So how about if he were to come around? How about we put him, Dan, I'm putting him on the edge. He's that edge rusher everybody is looking for right now. So you're trying to throw a pass to your left, and here he comes with his hands up.
Yeah, I mean, edge rusher is exactly where you could put him on the defensive side of the football. You're talking about a first step burst. Agility, the ability to bend. You can't get the ball up over his head. I mean, he would be a version of like Julius Peppers or Calais Campbell, like something like that, where his length would be just a massive issue. You can't throw screens his side, can't throw quick game his side, but he would be an incredible athlete off the edge.
Julius Peppers played basketball at North Carolina. Go ahead, Lewis, quick final thought.
There's a history of basketball players excelling at tight end in the NFL. And so, look, Antonio Gates, Tony Gonzalez. I mean, these guys were, and I played against Tony Gonzalez. Let me tell you, these guys just naturally have a way of boxing you out and making tough catches. I mean, LeBron James is one of the greatest athletes of all time. There's no question he would excel and be a dominant tight end in the NFL. There's absolutely no question. If he trained for it and he put his mind to it, there's no question he'd be an all-pro tight end.
Why do easily. I have this vision of Michael Jordan right now in his house watching this conversation saying, you know, if I tried, I would have been a better football player than LeBron James, too. That's just the thought I have in my head.
Because he's right.
Let's talk about a great quarterback, but one who's still looking for a team, and that's Cam Newton, still looking for a suitor. The former Heisman Trophy winner has been to 3 Pro Bowls. He was the 2015 MVP. He led Carolina to the Super Bowl. But we all know what's happened since then. He has struggled with injuries, a variety of them. A shoulder injury sidelined him for the final 2 games in 2018. A foot injury limited him to just 2 last year. He lost his final 8 starts in Carolina, and then in March, the Panthers released him quite unceremoniously and at a very awkward time. The Chargers explored signing Cam, but ended up passing. Here's their coach, Anthony Lynn, when he was asked about it.
Cam's a tremendous quarterback. He's been MVP of this league. He's led his team to the Super Bowl, you know, and he's healthy now, from what I hear. So Cam's going to be on somebody's roster. He's going to help somebody win a few games. But, yeah, we did take a look at that for sure.
All right, Diana's back. You had a chance to talk to Anthony Lynn. What can you tell us about the Chargers' approach at quarterback right now?
Yeah, I had multiple conversations with the Chargers organization over the last few months as we all realized, well, they certainly need to figure out what they're going to do at that spot. And it really all started with Tom Brady when he was a free agent. You know, the LA Chargers, they were all in on trying to get Brady there. In the end, it didn't work out because Brady wanted to be closer to his family on the East Coast. So after Brady was off the market, it was Tyrod Taylor the entire time. There was no other thought to perhaps grab another free agent like a Jameis Winston or a Cam Newton who was on the street looking for a job at the time. And the thought and the plan was, we're going to go into the draft to try to find who could perhaps be our future. So while Anthony Lynn, I think, did a really great job of praising Cam Newton, and I think there's a lot of people in the league who believe in what he said for the Chargers, they have felt from the start when Tom Brady moved on, they were all set with Tyrod Taylor. Okay. And finally, Greeny, I wanted to just go back to that whole basketball thing there. You asked the two guys here only played one sport in their life. I'm the multi-sport star here. I can tell you if LeBron James could have been a quarterback, you know. But you know what? You stick with those guys.
All right. Well, what do you think? Was he a quarterback? Was he a tight end? Or was he a pass rusher?
I think he's a receiver. I think he was held back in high school. He could have had so many more touchdowns, but he knew he was going to be an NBA player. Why not? He could be like the Megatron of 2020 if LeBron decides to come play in the NFL.
All right. Fair enough. We'll see if he does. Guys, let me come back to you on Cam Newton. And Dan, I will start with you because do you believe the Chargers, as you look at them right now in an AFC that a lot of question marks, do you believe they should have signed Cam Newton?
I do, Greeny. I've said that really for a couple months now, and this is one that I'm really struggling with. And obviously, there's some variables at play that we don't know about. Like, what is Cam's expectation money-wise and role-wise? Let's throw those out the window since I don't know those. And I sit here and I go, are the Chargers a better football team? Are they a scarier football team with Cam Newton or Tyrod Taylor? And for me, the easy answer is Cam Newton. Tyrod Taylor's best season is in 2017 where he was 8-6 for the Bills and he threw 14 touchdowns and 2,800 yards. You mean to tell me that you don't think a healthy Cam Newton can give you that plus some? Like plus a lot more? And I'm struggling with this one. Now, if Anthony Lynn had come out and said, listen, we were so focused on making sure that we were going to get Justin Herbert or Tua Tagovailoa at 6, and that's why we felt comfortable with Tyrod Taylor, that's fine. Like, I can get that because then that tells me that they are going to expedite that rookie onto the field. But to sit there and say that we feel better with Tyrod than we do a healthy Cam Newton, that makes no sense to me. That just I can't sit there and go, it was only Tom Brady or no one else, because it's not even a close comparison between the two players. And that's being as the reality is Cam's a much better player than Tyrod.
But healthy, of course, is the key word in all of this. And Lewis, he's got timing working against him on two different fronts. A, the timing of when Carolina chose to release him. And B, the timing of being a free agent during a pandemic when all these teams can't get their doctors with him. So you know how these things tend to work. How is he going to wind up on his next team? When and how will that wind up happening?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I think at this point, it's going to be one of those situations where either look, I mean, this could really be something that really drags on into the summer and maybe even to the beginning of the season and really is a signing that is precipitated by injury. Or it could be one of those situations where Cam lowers his financial demands. And I can't even say what his financial demands are at this point, but he lowers his financial demands, you know, proactively to such a ridiculous level that teams jump into the fray. And then it's about what is the best fit for him at this point. Look, I agree. I thought that LA Chargers should without a doubt have signed him. I think, as Dan said, I think there's no comparison between him and Tyrod Taylor. I think that's just silly to really even have that discussion. And I love Anthony Lynn, but obviously he's familiar with Tyrod, so I understand that situation. But again, fast forwarding to what is the best place for Cam going forward, I think it is all about fit, offensive fit and personality for Hit going forward. And I have said this repeatedly. I've said it on this show. He fits what Sean McVay is doing in L.A., the other L.A. team, the L.A. Rams. He fits what Sean's doing. I think Sean has the perfect teacher and mentor mentality that would jive well with what Cam is doing. And look, from a pure X and O standpoint, a team that runs their offense through the running game and then therefore it opens up the passing game, just think about Cam Newton in that offense with that run-centric offense and play-action passing game and move-the-pocket type passing game. It's perfect for him. It's just a matter of whether or not financially he would lower his demands to the point where they could swallow it from a salary cap perspective. I'd love to see it happen. I don't know if it ever would, but I'd love to see it happen.
Yeah, because Jared Goff, I think, has the second biggest contract currently of any player in the National Football League. Guys, stay with me. We have more to do, including this. If the Alabama Crimson Tide play football this fall, their preparation will look different. In what ways? Nick Saban will answer those questions, and you'll hear it next. Get up on ESPN.
Hello, this is your apartment. I need some favors from you. Your cat keeps rubbing against the kitchen island, and I can't return the favor. Can you give her extra pets for me? After that, could you bundle your renters and car insurance with Geico? We could save money, and it's easy to do online. And one last thing. Could you leave the TV on during the day? I need to catch up on my soaps.
Geico. For bundling made easy, go to geico.com today.
Even from an early age, it was full throttle. This kid is a totally different level.
They're like, who is this kid, Lance Armstrong?
I'm not saying I'm going to win every race in the world, but I can try.
On Wednesday, October 2nd, I was diagnosed with testicular cancer.
After you faced death, was it hard to take EPO?
No.
This is going to be interesting. The next 30 for 30, Lance, Sunday night, 9 Eastern, part one on ESPN and on the ESPN app. Okay, back to college football. Still working on solutions for how to play safely this year in light of the pandemic. Nick Saban of Alabama was on with SVP last night talking about what he hopes can happen if players are able to return to campuses this summer.
I'm hopeful, or I was hoping that, you know, when our players do get to come back in the summer, that, you know, we'll have some kind of what I called OTA days, or what we called OTA days when I was in the NFL, where just in shorts and T-shirts, you went out and worked with your players and practiced the things that you could practice so you could develop them. We didn't have any contact, but you could teach a lot of technique. You teach a lot of fundamental things without contact. And I think there's plenty of contact once you start, you know, fall camp to get ready for the season.
Well, there's so much to get into with all of this. And Dan is back with us here along with Laura and Paul. And Laura, I'll start with you because timing has been the most important piece of this all along. And now I'm reading about schools that are going to actually start their fall semester early so they can try and wrap up around Thanksgiving. How does that play into what we're expecting with college football?
Greeny, it plays into it a little bit, and that's more referring to actual classes and students on campus, which these are student athletes. At least that's how we keep classifying them, so it should matter. But I think that we may be looking at a lot of these football teams saying that almost all of their students and their student athletes are taking online classes anyway. That may be a way that a lot of these universities can even get things going technically earlier than they might be otherwise. And so there's this belief that there could be a resurgence of the virus in colder months, and that's where a lot of this is coming from. I have heard some models thrown around as everyone tries to figure this out that would have a season that begins on time and maybe ends early to avoid some of that could happen if the virus resurges. But then we also hear a equal amount of people saying, look, we're going to have to deal with this one way or the other, and people are going to get infected that play college football, that coach college football, etc. So it's more about how you deal with that as opposed to trying to guess what the virus is going to do and trying to shorten a season on the front end. It is, though, to your point, being considered as one of the many possibilities that could be in play here.
Yeah, so, Paul, yesterday on your show, and we played the soundbite earlier, Gordon Gee, who is the president of West Virginia, was previously the president of Ohio State, said, if a player on our football team tests positive for coronavirus, we have to have a plan in place that will enable us to not shut everything down and continue. What does that look like to you, and do you think it feels like a real possibility?
Yes, I do. This was really a seminal moment in this whole conversation, Greeny, because this is the first time a leader has talked about what we can do versus what we can't do. Mark Emmert has said we can't do this and we can't do that unless we do this or that. Gordon Gee, who is a very important person, he's 76 years old. He's twice been president of Ohio State. He's been at Colorado. He's been at Vanderbilt. He's been at West Virginia. He understands big-time college football, and he is insistent that there is going to be a season and we'll deal with it. And the most important thing he said is, we're not going to panic. We're going to stay the course. course. Now, that's easier said than done, but it is positivity for a sport that has that is in desperate need of it.
Dan, what is it? As the former player, now that's really what I want to hear from you here, as the former player in you, what do you think of all this?
Oh, there's tons, Greeny. You know, if I'm a player in college football right now, I think the biggest thing is I need to look at the leaders, not only of my institution, but really college football overall. I need to look at them and trust that what they have planned for us is going to protect me. That's my biggest question. And that's my biggest challenge to the people, the leaders that are involved. You've got tens of thousands of 18 to 22 year old kids that are looking at you for leadership. And they need to know that they can trust you with their lives. That they can trust you with their lives. And their moms and dads need to know that you are going to put the health and their livelihood before anything else. And these institutions and coaching staffs spend hours and hours and hours prepping for games, prepping for the one moment that they don't want to be surprised for or surprised in with that football game, because it's the difference between winning and losing. They need to have the same kind of mindset with this. They need to not be surprised by anything that could come down the line here in the fall. And so if I'm a player, I need to look at those people and trust that what they're telling me is the truth, and trust that what they're telling me is for, you know, my best interest involved. Also, what happens if I'm a player and I do get the disease and then I have to sit out for 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks? Does it affect my redshirt status? Can I get that year back? Do I need to go to the NFL draft? What happens if I'm a guy that misses time and my draft stock plummets because of it? Do I get some kind of insurance? Do I have to sign a waiver? There's tons of questions that the players should be asking the leaders, and the leaders need to have the answers, because that's the only way that the players are going to trust. Those guys are going to put us in the best situation for us to play football and stay healthy.
So, Laura, yeah, it's easy to say, have a plan, don't panic. Those are the things people are saying. But then you actually have to do those things. What do they look like? What does it look like when they all come back on campus and invariably, inevitably, someone tests positive?
Well, look, I can tell you, first of all, that they're nowhere close to having a waiver in place. I've heard that floating around for a while, but I was told as recently as yesterday that they are nowhere close to having that in place that would say basically a player signs, you know, assuming whatever risk they're going to assume. That may be something that happens, but it's not happening anytime soon. And really what we're talking about here, and many of the decision makers that I've spoken to, is giving the best advice possible and equipping these players with masks, with gloves, with protective measures to do outside of their football playing and outside of their training in the weight room. In the weight room, we're talking about only 10 guys in there at a time, then a full cleaning of the weight room before the next 10 come in, doing everything possible they can to try to keep things as safe as possible. But either way, and everybody's acknowledging this, they are all assuming some sort of risk by putting themselves in this situation, by being put in this situation. And as it relates to scholarships, I think that's where it gets really tricky, because you're talking about these universities having no game plan for how to deal with this, for lack of a better way to put it. There's no roadmap here. So if they say, well, yeah, we'll honor red shirts or we'll go ahead and extend a scholarship, how does that then prevent them potentially from maybe bringing in their next class of freshmen? That's where it gets really dicey there. And we're talking about the money that's needed to continue to provide scholarships, to give these athletes the opportunities that they have. That's got to be sorted out. And I think that's where they're still working on this. And it is something that, I mean, Dan, to your point, it's like every single day they're trying to game plan here as they would for every single game. But this is much more complicated, and obviously the stakes are much higher.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's so much here that it's impossible to get to all of it. But, Paul, I did see in the notes you have questions about how some games can even be played without fans in the stands. What's that?
Well, I mean, it's not only a financial situation that goes with that, Greeny, but there are many college administrators who say that we are not going to allow that. So there's a big dispute there from the NCAA on down. But if I could jump in and say one last thing about what Dan said, Dan's 100% correct. But here's the issue I hear from college football coaches privately. They're as concerned about the player behavior as the protocol, because if a player goes out, gets exposed wherever he goes, and then brings it back, he puts the entire unit at risk.
There's so much here that we can get to. And one of the questions that we will look into as we go forward is, look, there are a lot of players playing college football because they want to make the NFL. There are just as many that are there because it gives them an opportunity to go to college. If those kids don't want to put themselves at risk, do they lose their scholarship? We'll get answers to all of these guys. Outstanding. We can do an hour on this every single day. Meanwhile, tomorrow we have Jim Harbaugh coming up on the show. We'll see what answers he's got. Michigan's head coach will join our program in this hour, 9:30 Eastern tomorrow live. We'll ask how college football can return, what it would look like, and what his plans are. So much with Jim Harbaugh tomorrow live right here on Get Up. Meanwhile, we took announcements from the governors of California and New York as good news yesterday. What did Stephen A. and Max think? Are we closer to seeing sports return? First Take answers those questions when they follow us in 5 minutes right here on ESPN. Tomorrow night on ESPN, we relive the final game Michael Jordan ever played for the Bulls. Game 6, the 98 finals against the Jazz. We will have behind-the-scenes footage and sounds, along with film angles that are unique from the original TV broadcast. That's tomorrow night, 9 Eastern on ESPN and the ESPN app. This has been a fantastic morning, and we thank you for getting up with us. The subject will turn to the optimism about the return of sports as I join the crew on First Take, starting right now.